Okay, good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, August 23rd, and this is Henry Harris, and this is another week of the weekly Emunah Teleform. And we're continuing topics associated with the time of year that we're in right now, Elul, preparation for the big days of Yomim Noraim. And I would love to speak a little bit about my understanding about the connection between knowing what's true and the profound blessing of rachamim, of mercy. Which is over and over again a theme of the days that we see leading up to Rosh Hashanah and all the way through to Yom Kippur, and of course Yom Kippur itself, the essential quality of rachamim that we're meant to partake of or understand. In terms of really maximizing the gifts of these days that we're coming towards. So again, the connection between knowing what's true, knowing what's not true, meaning understanding what's really driving change, what's really causing reality, and what's not causing reality, and how that leads to, at least in my understanding, a profound opportunity for seeing rachamim. So I want to share with you a little bit about an experience where I saw this, or I see it more clearly now in retrospect, but it was certainly true while it was unfolding. I would say, just as a general rule, that every time there's something shifted meaningfully in my life, and thank God, I think this is true for everybody. There's no person in the world that's not seeing new things, that's not gaining insight, that's not finding ways to turn corners in places where life can be difficult. Every time when I look back over the course of my years where I saw something move, something loosened up, there was what coincided or what helped facilitate that was a deepening appreciation of acceptance, a deepening appreciation of kind of what is, and you know, a dropping of judgment, at least in my own personal judgment about the way things could be, the way things should be, the way things I am, or the way I am, or the way I'm not. You know, and that's what I'm going to share with you right now is when an experience that I had. I think I've shared on prior occasions on this call that when I first became introduced to Torah in a more significant way, it was quite some time ago. I was in my early 20s. And I was definitely say that I was struggling at that point in my life. I had a habit of quite a bit of I had a habit of negativity. I had a habit of judgment of self, of others. It was just an unchecked kind of unceasing flow of negativity that I didn't know what to do with. You know, I could see that I had that habit. I could sense that others didn't have that habit, but I didn't know what to do about it. And so adding to all the negativity was the judgment that I'm not doing well, and I could, in theory, be doing better. And why are others seeming to do better? And why, you know, there was a lot of weight and a lot of noise, and it was very, very difficult to move around with that. And I don't remember the precise sequence of events, but I do remember there was a certain point as I labored under the kind of ongoing inquiry, why is it that so, like I'd look around at my fellows and say, like, he just doesn't seem to be struggling in the way I am. Why is he able to move on? Why is he, you know, why am I struggling? With all that inquiry, there was a certain point where something shifted. There was a certain point where, alongside my learning about Jewish wisdom and Emunah, but ultimately I believe alongside the gift of insight, really it was the gift of insight. There was a certain moment where what occurred to me as I was struggling and struggling to figure out how did I get to this place and why, how do I get out of this place and why did others not get to this place, as I was struggling with that, there was an insight. There was an insight that came to me that said, you know, who says that you are directly accountable for this habit that you have of indulging in generating negative thinking. Who says that you're the one, and that you can and should be focused on, you know, how did it happen, or why are you different? Who says? And then an image came to mind, like a very powerful metaphor came to mind, and the metaphor was: imagine your life was such that you were parachuted into this world, like you jumped out of a plane with a parachute, and you landed somewhere. You know, you didn't personally choose where you landed. You landed somewhere, and then where you landed, you kind of awoke to the realization, well, I have somewhere to get to. There's some place I want to get to. I want to get to some, let's say, far border, or from some place far away from where I parachuted down, where I wasn't the one who chose the location of where I jumped and where I landed. I parachuted down into a certain place, and I had a distance to travel. I had a goal to get to. I can become focused. I can stay focused on why am I in this location, and how did I get here, and why are others not in this location. Or I could simply focus my attention on where do I want to go? You know, where do I want to go? What is it that's possible to, what's a meaningful place to get to? You know, where do you want to place your focus? And of course, again, I'm only describing this, this is a beautiful concept, and it's certainly a concept that on an idea level I think many people have heard before and many people have benefited from, but to me the essence of it was that it showed up as an insight. There was nowhere, no one taught this to me, no one said this to me. Even if somebody had, of course, it's still the case that it can only touch us through the gift of divine thought in a moment. And that's what happened. My heart opened up, and I said, there was a settling down that I realized, like, why am I giving myself such a hard time? Like, I was parachuted into a location, and now I have a job to do, and it's a beautiful job. Who says that my job is less than, could be, should be different? It's a job, and this is a job that I've been given, and let's embrace it. And it was amazing because something shifted when I went from the realization that I didn't cause, and therefore I'm not somehow to blame for having caused a habit or a certain state of mind or a certain set of mental experiences. I was so much more available to look and consider, well, okay, well, what's the opportunity and what is there to do? And again, it was an insight. It was not a technique that I can replicate for myself or suggest that others can replicate for themselves, even though there's wisdom there, is that I let go of a lot of busy strategizing, blaming, judgmental thinking. And I somehow just woke up to, there's opportunity here. I've been given a mission, and why would I want to turn my back on it and distract myself? Let's be here with this mission. And I have to say that there was something that I remember encountering with, it was not long before Yom Yom Narayim of that year. It was not long before Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And I remember the realization that once I saw that I didn't kind of irresponsibly allow myself to, or I didn't somehow choose in an irresponsible kind of negligent manner my habit, I was open to the job of what could be and how I could go about doing it differently. But even more importantly, I was open to the truth that I wasn't really on the hook to make the change. I was on the hook to kind of want to the change, desire the change, but that I saw that the Almighty was the source of my life experience till that point. He set up my life circumstances, my inner character, the world in which I grew up and the challenges that I faced. And he engineered the whole thing and was placing me in a kind of, he was the one who chose the landing. And now I had an opportunity and a responsibility to look at. And so it seemed only normal to me that if he was the one responsible for kind of setting up that context, that he would also be responsible for allowing me to move to another place. I just had to want it, and I had to kind of give myself over to it. And that's what I saw and felt more available to. And here's where I want to share something profound about rachamim that I think, you know, ties in. And I have gratitude for a wonderful teacher and author by the name of Mrs. Chaya Toby Friedman, who actually has come to a number of our conferences. And she writes a book called The Secret to Miraculous Salvation, in which she quotes a Gomorrah from Brachos, in which the Gomorrah asks the Gomorrah discusses the Almighty's prayer. What is the Almighty's prayer? The Almighty has a prayer. It's as follows. Yehi Ratzon, may it be my will. Yehi Ratzon Melefana, may it be my will. Sheyichvashu Rachamai, that my character, my mida of Rachmanis, of mercy, should overcome eskasi. It should, my mercy should overcome my anger. The golu rachamai al midoisai, and my mercy, my trait of mercy, should override all my other midos, all my other character traits and practices. The es noheg, and I, the Almighty, is saying this. I will act im bonai with my children. The midas harachamim, with the attribute of mercy, ve'akonis lehem lifnim mishur sedin, and I will enter into a relationship with them in which I will give them beyond what they deserve. So again, the Almighty has a prayer. His prayer is that I should overcome my own anger, that my mercy should overcome my anger, that my mercy should override all my other means of interacting with my children, and that I interact with my children in a manner that is beyond the nature of what they deserve. That's the prayer that the Almighty makes. So in her book, Mrs. Friedman describes how, like, it seems strange that the Almighty should have a request, you know, that he should have a prayer. What's in the way of the Almighty fulfilling his own desire? If he has a desire to allow his rachamim to override his anger and his, you know, strict law practice, like, what should be in the way? And the answer is that he himself, so to speak, created a world. He created the world in such a way that he is bound by a kind of a laws of justice and merits and demerits. He created that system of din. But simultaneously, he created the possibility of an override, something that allows that the whole idea of a check, of checks and balances, of what you have, you know, merits and demerits. Even though he created the world in that manner and he bound himself by that, he also created an override. And his desire is that the Jewish people do what they do in order to affect to allow for that override. So what is it that allows for that? How do the Jewish people allow God to override his character of justice? By understanding and acknowledging that everything is a gift. By understanding and realizing that even the concept of justice is itself a creation, that all there is the Almighty. All there is the Almighty. And that his knowing that his desire is to behave and to act toward us beyond the nature of our own merits allows us to see more clearly how and where he's showing up with mercy, how he's showing up and providing us with things that are beyond our merits. And then in acknowledging that, then it's only we allow ourselves to become a vessel, to see more clearly and to be recipients more clearly of his largesse. When we think we're working in a system of merits and demerits, and I'm earning and I'm not earning, so he himself operates in a system of merits, demerits, and he's limited by our understanding of his involvement in our lives. But when we open our hearts and when we see more clearly how everything is already his blessing, and there's such a degree of the weightedness toward his kindness, and everything is his gifts. All there is his doing. So then we empower, so to speak, that's the power that he endowed us with, to open the world to his involvement in a way that overrides his justice. And I guess in describing my story, I think that, you know, I started off by saying, just to review, that I'm sharing the connection between understanding what's true, understanding how understanding what really drives change, what really moves things in this world, is what positions us to be more open and more connected to mercy, more connected to rachamim, and it allows it primes the pump, so to speak, for his involvement in a way that's beyond our merits. Because again, when I was caught up in like, why am I here and why am I struggling and how come others are not struggling, it was very much a conversation about what did I do, what did I not do, and how do I get beyond where I'm at and why am I not beyond where I'm at. It was very much a world in which, even as I was already believing in God, I was still focused on myself as the driving force. You know, I should be able to do better, and why am I not? And there was a certain moment where I realized, you know what, I didn't do this. Like, I didn't drive this process. The whole thing is something that's being driven by the real power source is not me and my choices. Not that, again, my choices don't matter. But in terms of producing a certain state of mind, in terms of producing a certain habit, there's a divine input that is setting the stage for where I stand, for my mental outlook, for my mental landscape. And when I saw the gift of that, when I saw more clearly how I was parachuted in, it was not a blame thing. At that moment, it became so much more apparent to me to like turn to him from a place of mercy, you know, from an understanding, look, everything I have, you've given. So I don't really have a pretense that I should change my life directly. I'm committed. I care. I'm not giving up because I don't view the fact that he is the source of my experience as a reason to be in despair. I trust that if he's provided me with this challenge, that there's something that he wants me to see. He's inviting me to see something, and it was a gift. I didn't despair when I saw that it was him that provided that challenge. It simply quieted me down to the point where I realized, well, if he's provided this, then I can let go of the urgency of my changing it, and I can really just turn toward him and say, you know, I don't know how to get from point A to point B. I'm not sure how to change my internal experience. I don't know how to let go of these mental habits that I've got. I know I want to change. I know that you've provided the context and the challenge, and I know that you're the source of how I might move beyond it, because you're the power source. So it was that letting go, the acceptance that I'm not to blame, that is directly linked to the quality of being open to rachamim. You know, the profound quality that we're turning to on these days of judgment is not, you know, I guess just to sum up, is I'm not coming into the days of judgment primarily relying on how will I get a good judgment through my choices. You know, my choices will tip the balance, per se. Now, does that mean that I'm not going to exert myself? Of course, I have to push myself to the fullest, but when I push myself to the fullest thinking that it's kind of in my hands to produce a result, I tend to get, I get caught up. I get self-centered. I get very into my own personal thinking, and I get slowed down. When I let go of the premise of I'm responsible for where I'm at and I'm responsible to actually produce a change, that's when I slow down and I realize I want things, but I'm not the power source. Almighty, you're the power source. I'm turning to you. I'm going to do everything I can with the freedom to know that it's not literally the results in my hands. That liberates me. You know, that opens my heart. It opens me to being able to turn to him with a sincere desire to make change, but with the trust that I'm not really the one driving the process. So that to me is, you know, so much a part of the rachamim that is these days, that we over and over again we're saying the 13 attributes of mercy. Why is it that we say it hundreds of times between, you know, the end of Elul through till Yom Kippur? Hundreds of times we reference mercy because we know that going into a process of judgment, we want to do everything we can, but we want to do it knowing that ultimately we're relying on the attribute of mercy, the Almighty's desire to act toward us beyond our merits. And that, of course, requires us to understand and see the truth of what that means, that he's acting toward us beyond our merits. Okay, I'm going to pause there and see whether that made any sense or whether it's registering in a way that's helpful.
Yeah, that did make some sense. I don't want to think about it too much because I think like maybe I'm going to make it into a technique or something.
Right.
But just to acknowledge that, you know, when we get caught up in things, it's usually because we think that we're responsible for everything, and right. It could just be that you just landed somewhere like a parachute, and your job is to kind of, without judgment, just say, this is where I am, and let's see what we can do with this, without any judgment backed up.
That's right. And that happens, you know, in the midst of a, you know, today's conversation with one of my children, or today's conversation with with my spouse or whomever, you know, when I find myself falling into reactivity or some kind of a, you know, a feeling of lost, whatever, negativity. You know, there's a certain point where it always happens that we wake up and we realize, wait a second, something's fishy about this, you know. And in that moment, there's an opportunity for judgment and an opportunity for blame and an opportunity for trust. Okay, this is the human experience I'm having, you know. I'm having a human experience. Let's accept the responsibility for my part and acknowledge the degree to which there's a human quality, this, you know, and there is a responsibility. There's 100%, you know, in any Tshuva process, in any process of stepping toward Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, there is absolutely a responsibility. And I guess, you know, as we've said on so many occasions, it's clarifying the nature of our responsibility, of knowing what's within our bounds and what's not within our bounds. That's what allows us to navigate, you know, knowing that what's true about my responsibility is to see, to the best of my ability, what's true and what's not true. You know, if I get reactive, it's obviously the case that I lost track of what's true. I thought that this person's behavior, words, etc., was sourcing my experience, and I reacted. Within that experience was having lost track of that. I want to remind myself, I want to reaffirm both the truth that there's only one source, and remind myself of the fact of the human condition, how normal and how common it is to make mistakes, and how that mistake process is a growth, you know, it's a learning curve. It's not possible not to have that learning curve.
You know, it's interesting. I wonder, like, is our goal to kind of like just be human and kind of just be and try to see Hashem, or are we ultimately supposed to like not ever get reactive? Because I mean, organically so, because you know we see that it's really, you know, we see the truth of things all the time, but it's like, I don't think we're meant to see the truth of things 100% of the time. It sounds like it's too perfect, too much. Maybe we're just meant to just be in the moment, and if things occur to us later, like, oh, we shouldn't have been reactive, you know, then we can make amends. But I'm wondering, like, maybe it's setting myself up for failure to think, like, you know, someday I'll never react anytime.
Yeah, I don't think that that's really in the cards for us, in the sense that if we're really growing in our awareness of our relationship with the Almighty and his wants of us, then you know, we'll find that there's unlimited levels of playing fields, you know, and there's unlimited growth potential where new, you know, right now it might be that it would be astonishing for me to, you know, to spend an entire week with my children and not be reactive to them. But I'm not really dealing in a realm beyond my children, because I don't have, let's say, a leadership role in a broader context. But as I find my way and gain comfort and peacefulness about that playing field, my children, then I start to take on more responsibility outside of my home, and then we get to the level of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe had millions of people yelling at him. We have no water, and why can't you bring us water? And in that moment, with millions of people yelling at him, he became angry at them, at the rock, So that was suffice it to say, that was a playing field. That was like a whole new level of playing field. Like, I can relate to the mistake in the sense that I do that, I do something similar in a much smaller context. In terms of the context in which he was operating, that's a profoundly different, playing field. He was literally seeing himself as responsible for the entire Jewish people. That's our goal. Our goal is to to be present to our responsibilities, to be present to the truth of God's power and the truth about nothing other than God in the various places in which we're responsible. And as we grow and as we see those things, because we will, it's impossible that we won't gain insight and see new things, then we'll find that what was yesterday, a common area of pitfall, today and tomorrow are going to become less common. And then there'll be new opportunities that we'll see new opportunities and new challenges because we will grow. As we grow, our vision grows, we see things that looked as not even an option, they'll occur to us as opportunities. We'll step into those opportunities, but then we'll fall down in them, and then we'll grow. You know what I'm saying? Like, so there's no limit, like there's no limit to the growth that we can have. And the Yetzer Hara is still showing up on every level. Moshe Rabbeinu had a Yetzer Hara, and I have a Yetzer Hara. In that conceptual sense, we're quite similar, just that his playing field was, quite a bit quite a bit beyond my, experience.
I don't know if this is what you meant, but what I heard from that was that even Moshe Rabbeinu, got angry. Of course, his role was, the ultimate role, but I guess, no one's perfect.
Yeah, a parent starts off with a small child, where everything is, it's meaningful and it's significant what's going on with the child, with the infant, and then the toddler. Suffice it to say that even though it can feel unsettling a parent can feel reactive and agitated by things going on with the toddler, when that toddler is in his 20s, and the choices that child is making are much more significant, the potential for reactivity and concern and feeling, agitated are greater, It's a different playing field. It's a bigger playing field. So the Almighty kind of brings us through our lives in a way that there's no shortage of new and new arenas of opportunity to see this truth, where the stakes grow over time.
Okay.
That's what I see, And having an appreciation for the growth is very valuable. Having appreciation for the fact that, wow, I'm still judging myself. Even after all these years, I still judge myself. Okay, well, what are you judging yourself for? Are you judging yourself for the same things that you did 20 years ago, 10 years ago? My guess, that's what I remember sharing, how I had that experience of seeing the nature of thought, the nature of outside-in thinking doesn't leave us. We don't lose the outside-in human tendency to go outside-in. But as we learn and as we grow, as we gain understanding of the inside-out nature of our lives, we become different people. The parameters of our vision are growing, even if we're not conscious of them fully at all times. It's certainly the case that that is true, you know, that we're growing, and there's something to have gratitude over. That's something to notice and to look at and to recognize, wow, I'm different, you know. I'm still struggling. See, that's what I think is a blessing for people who gain insight about the inside-out nature, is that at a certain point they recognize about themselves that they're never not going to have struggles. They're always going to have struggles. It's just that they come to there's a familiarity with how that struggle is working inside of them and inside of every person. There's a certain permission to not to be lax about the struggle, but to not have the same, you know, feeling of urgency. Again, I don't want to struggle. You know, there's room for struggle in my life. When I struggle, it feels uncomfortable, but I have a greater familiarity with the normalness of that struggle, and that's what allows me to be in the struggle and not run from the struggle. You know, this understanding allows us to stay put. Like Shlomo HaMelech says, "Kishatale alecha ruach ha-moshel," when the spirit of that ruler comes over you, meaning the Yetzer Hara, "Mekaimcha al tanach," don't leave your place. You know, it's so tempting to want to run from the pain of the struggle that I'm in, to run to anything, to run to food, to run to an angry action, to run to internet, to run whatever it is, you know, that we might run from in order to escape the feeling of struggle, the feeling of running up against our limits, the feeling of running up against our own insecure thought. You know, part of our journey, part of our learning curve.
I love that idea.
What's that?
I love the idea that you're saying. Thank you. I never heard it put like that before. Just like I just want to laugh. Like, you know, being me for as many years as I'm me, it's like, why didn't I think of that already? Not to be judgmental, but it's like, of course there's a struggle that, you know, everyone has their struggle. Like, why? Like, just accept it. Like, that's your struggle. You know, run away from it. Like, that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
And never, like, it just comes as new right now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, and back to, you know, as I've mentioned on many occasions, the metaphor of the birth process, you know. There's a greater recognition of the fact that we don't resist birth, you know, we don't resist it. We're present to it. It's not pleasant. There are times where it can feel quite painful, you know. And I don't mean to take away from that. But that the context in which we understand birth allows us to be in it, to feel the pain of it, and yet all that while to trust that there is something profoundly divine, you know, being unfolding and coming to life. Where and when and how it's going to finish, I don't know. You know, and at the end of it, there will be a baby. So I'm free. I'm really free to encounter these struggles, encounter these contractions.
Yes, I love thinking of it like a birth.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I did receive a number of comments and questions, which I am very grateful for, Lior, including from you, and I wanted to, if you're interested, take a moment to respond to some of them and see if that's of interest to folks. So you mentioned, you know, what, first of all, you asked, where does the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov come in? is that hidden from our view, like free will seems to be. You know, my understanding of the Yetzirah and the Yetzirah Tov is the fact that the Gemara speaks of the idea that the Almighty is renewing the Yetzirah every day. He renews the Yetzirah every day, and elsewhere it speaks of the idea that a person doesn't transgress. A person doesn't transgress unless there enters into him a spirit of insanity. Ruach Shtos being that spirit of insanity. That's the Yitzhahara. The Yitzhahara presents to us. It's a force that the Almighty is running and maintaining and renewing moment to moment, and He renews it within us. It shows up within our own consciousness as if it's, you know, an outlook of reality. And as we understand, there are times where it's noticeable to us. There are times where it's not even noticeable to us, you know, it's not noticeable to us at the moment, although after the fact it's noticeable to us. Like, people can speak openly about the fact that, like, yeah, I committed that transgression, I committed that crime, I committed that, and it was wrong. Like, I know fully and clearly that it was wrong. In the moment, why did you do it? Because I didn't see in the moment, right? Yetzirah is this force of thought that is part of what the Almighty allows us to see moment to moment to moment. And the Yetzirah and the Yetzirah Tov are these two kind of, I call them platforms. You know, it's where I see the words, you know, in the Shema that I talk about, the Be'avta as Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha, all the ways. I mean, there's so many places where we see the reference to levavcha, to the heart as being a plural entity. The fact that there's two vases, the levavcha, I could say libecha, but it says levavcha. That's suggestive of there being two portals of thought, that the Almighty, the same way that He's pumping my physical heart with blood and I'm not managing that, so He's pumping my spiritual consciousness with two platforms of thought. One, very self-centered and insecure, in which the world looks and feels threatening and unsafe. And one in which, and I'm alone, and one in which the world is a beautiful and expansive, there's a oneness to the world. There's something beautiful and broad and wise and meaningful, and I'm part of that, and it's bigger than me, and I'm part of that bigness, and you know, and so we're being gifted with those two platforms ongoingly. That's my understanding of the Yetzirah, the Yetzirah Tov, and included in the nature of that challenge is that there will be times where the Yetzirah is so present in our experience that we won't notice that we're standing in the Yetzirah until after the fact. You know, we literally won't. The test might not be in the moment. The test might be after the moment, after the fall, after the reactivity, after the mistake of, you know, from anger or passion or whatever it is. The times where the opportunity of free will begins after the fall. I'm not suggesting that we don't view ourselves as accountable. I don't understand. Ultimately, the heart of a man and the heart of a person is in, you know, Hashem sees what's in our hearts, and He is the only judge there is, as we say on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So I don't mean to absolve myself or others of actual accountability for reactivity. I do know that the Torah does speak to that, though, that it makes sense to me that there are times where what's beyond, where I can fall down, and the free will really begins when I fall down and wake up to having fallen. And what am I going to do having felt that fall? Am I going to identify with it and identify with despair? Or do I acknowledge, okay, I fell, now what, you know? So that's a little bit about what I see in terms of Yetzirah, Yetzirah Tov, and free will.
Thank you. That was actually a question for someone I know, so I just wrote that all down, and I'm going to let them know that.
Okay, good. Okay, now you also mentioned that you've heard Gedolim speaking of being scared leading up to Rosh Hashanah, that there's a certain Yiras Adin, there's a certain fear, you know, that great, great people feel as the days of judgment approach us. And the question is you know, is that a healthy fear? Is that a healthy scare? And obviously, you know, insofar as we're talking about gedolim, it makes sense that it is. The question is, you know, we always speak of fear as a function of insecure thoughts, you know. That's at least what I'm thinking, I'm hearing in your question. You know, how do we reconcile the fear that gedolim have in approaching these great days and the understanding that we understand that fear is typically associated with insecure thought? And I guess what I would say to that is that there are two different types of fear. You know, there's fear of, you know, there's a self-centered fear, and then there's a fear of something there's a fear of awe. You know, there's an awe of something greater. Like, for example, my Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Weinberg, used to give this example how when he would talk about Yiras Hashem, of having awe or fear of the Almighty, he would say that people often give fear like a bad rap, like who wants to be afraid? So he would say, a lot of people want to be afraid. I'll show you. And he says, how many people go on scary rides? You know, lots of these, the line goes around the corner to go on, you know, intense roller coasters, to go into scary films and stuff like that. Like people do want fear. There is embedded in the human spirit is a realization of a desire for fear, of there being something of value in fear. Of course, the roller coaster scary movie fear is not the one that we're after, but it points, it's a very profound idea here. All of humanity does acknowledge deep inside their soul that there's something to be sought after in the experience of fear. What they're looking for is the sense of consequence. You know, the people who go to the movies to watch the scary movies, or they watch the thriller action. I used to always give the example of James Bond. You know, James Bond, the great action thriller stories where, you know, James Bond walking into his hotel room after the end of a long day, he's very careful as he walks in because he doesn't know if somebody booby-trapped the hotel room earlier that day to try and sabotage him. So he's walking with a tremendous kind of carefulness and thoughtfulness, and there's a fearfulness that the audience is experiencing as they're watching him walk into the hotel room, like, what's going to happen? Is somebody going to jump out of the closet on him? But that fear is something that people want. Why do they want that? Because inherently, we want to feel, human beings desire to feel the truth that life is consequential. That's what we're after. Fear is simply an awareness of the truth that life is consequential, that my choices are truly significant. Not that they're significant in the sense that I'm in control and I better ratchet up the pressure on myself, because in truth I'm not in control over results. But I am aware that my choices, the internal reality that I have choice over, is massively consequential. And the good news is that I always, you know, with sincere effort, I always have within me the ability to be a chooser, the ability to recognize, oh, there is consequence in this moment, there's consequence in this moment, there's consequence in this moment. There's effort involved in that. It's a little more effort than sitting in a movie theater watching, you know, James Bond go about his business on a movie screen. But deep down, human beings want to live a life of consequence. And so for gedolim, great Jewish men and women who live with that awareness of the consequence of their choice and the understanding that the Yetzirah is a real, it's a challenge, it's a real challenge. The understanding that that human beings make mistakes, it's normal to make mistakes, and that I don't want to. I want to be conscious. I want to be careful. Knowing how grand and awesome the gift of life is, how grand and awesome the gift of each moment is, I want to be present to that. Now, typically those in gedolim are, you know, their consciousness of God's love is parallel to their awareness of the opportunity and, God forbid, the lost opportunity, right? So they're not walking around, you know, burdened by that feeling. But that's, to me, the fear that they're experiencing is the healthy awareness of the power of their choice.
So basically what I'm hearing is that when people experience consequences to their actions, it actually gives them a sense of security that, you know, someone's watching and that life is fair and that, you know, there is accountability, because if there weren't any consequences given, then people could just run amok. So there is security in seeing that life has consequences.
Well, there's a security, you know, what I see is that a consequences allows a person to it wakes people up, it matures people, it allows them to come face to face with their own, with their need for something greater than themselves, you know, with their need to take life seriously, the opportunities of life seriously. You know, it's like, I want my children to feel that their choices have consequences, because I want them to understand that there's something that they want to, like, they have a certain instinctual response to something that might not be constructive. I would like them to feel the consequences of those choices so that then they have the opportunity to say, wait a second, is there an alternative? What else is out there besides my instinctual response? You know, it allows them to look inward. It encourages them to look beyond the moment's kind of instinctual reaction, because, you know, they're being confronted by the downside of their instinctual reaction. Oh, well, what else is there? What where else can I find something? You know, that's the healthy, that's what Yira does. You know, Yira it matures us. It deepens us. It allows us to realize there's so much that can be accomplished with a certain thoughtfulness and choice. So let's see where those resources lie. Like, oh, that's God. I should probably want to connect to God. You know, like yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes me think how in Hebrew, Yira is so similar to the word for seeing.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yira allows us to see what's out there, and once we see what's out there, then we can navigate. We can tune into what's really worthwhile, and we can turn to the Almighty. We can truly do that. And, you know, back to the whole inside-out understanding that we're talking about is that the more we see with clarity what is driving our a real world inside of us that is not at our total control. You know, there's an inner world that is unfolding inside of us that's not different than the world outside of us that's unfolding, that we can know and understand on some level, we can interact with, but it's not in our control. That gives us clarity, it gives us potential acceptance, it gives us the ability to navigate. And again, to, you know, not to misunderstand our responsibility and then get tripped up and discouraged. And on the contrary, it allows us to appreciate and see the just how present the Almighty is in our lives. You know, it's this moment-to-moment truth that He's involved in our lives. And of course, in my experience, it's only encouraged me to rely on Him, you know, to trust in Him, to see Him, and to make room for Him more and more in my life.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Yeah. Well, anything else in terms of thoughts or comments about this inside-out understanding or any other topic?
I know, like, you know, like, these ideas are, like, so easy to learn, but for me, even easier to misunderstand. I know I've had, like, a misunderstanding, like, oh, like, I don't have to do any effort at all, and everything that comes to me is just a thought, and I can, you know, act on it or just let it go. And I feel like I let go of some really good thoughts that maybe I should have acted on, because I would like kind of over mellow it and say like, oh, whatever, like that's just a thought, like I could go back and get this possession that I think I might, that would be helpful on my trip, or I could, oh, but that's just a thought, so I'll just let it go, and I'll, and then like I see later, like, oh, maybe I could have used that. So I don't know, that's a silly example, but I think, I don't know, I wonder if in my misunderstanding, I kind of, it's like, how do I know that, how do I know whether I'm treating the thoughts that come into my head with the proper, treating them in the proper way, like basically like the clarity to, you know, appreciate the thought for what it is and know whether to act on it or not.
That's an interesting question. Very interesting question. You know, in other words, you're sensing that about yourself, that there's a feeling of, do I really know myself, or do I know how to navigate what is helpful thought, you know, and what's not helpful thought? Am I...
Right. Like, I think... Like, I know one time I wanted to ask this question at a seminar, and I ended up not because I just... Because I guess at that point it was clear to me, like, oh, like, I'll just know. I'll just know if it's the right thought or not. And then later I realized, well, I don't know. Maybe I'm, like, overthinking things, and maybe I really should act on it. And then there's all this, like, you know, thinking too much about my thoughts. So, you know, it could be that musing about it is maybe not helpful, and maybe I will just know, and I don't know.
Well, you know what's interesting is that even your asking of this question right now is, of course, happening in the context of, you know, the nature of thought, right? Like, in other words, the feeling that you're standing in, which is a feeling of uncertainty, yeah?
Yeah.
There's a certain feeling of unclarity, of uncertainty, like, how do I do, you know? Now, that, I would point to the truth that all states of mind, all feeling states are themselves born of thought, right? They're all an expression of a manifestation of thought in this moment. So I would say like this, more than it's the, you know, based on what we understand, what we are talking about all the time, that more than your uncertainty is a function of the fact of sometimes you have thoughts that you get and then you let go of them and then you realize afterwards maybe that could have taken that thought and done more with it. More than it's a function of that kind of scenario, it's what's showing up in this moment. There's an uncertainty that you're feeling niggled by. You're feeling a little bit, you know, kind of... I'm not suggesting that you're, like, losing sleep over this, but even to the extent that it's a feeling like... You know, any question that we have, it's an experience of thought in this moment.
Okay.
So, in a sense... I could suggest to you, well, you know, I guess how would I want to? I guess it's just to simply trust in the moment that you're finding yourself that, you know, you're going to stand in the understanding that you're going to have. And you can't stand in understanding that you don't have. And you, all you can do is kind of your best to see and appreciate that. Like, in other words, the realization, you know, it's about gratitude. It's about acceptance. It's about gratitude. It's about acceptance. Gratitude in the moments where you see and are acknowledge a helpful thinking. You're in a mood where you see and you're just, this is what I should do with my baby. Or I just feel nice right now. I just feel happy. I just feel content right now with what I understand and with what I don't understand. Like, your understanding of the inside-out understanding is not separate from your moods, right? Like your total knowledge, anyone listening to this should know, you're drawn to learn about the inside out understanding because you sense the truth. There's wisdom and deep meaning and truth in there. But insofar as you're a human being and your internal experience is moving, your comfort level with your own clarity about the inside understanding is moving, you know. Your moods, you get a little more comfortable and accepting and peaceful, and you sense that the value of this learning process is good and it's helping you. And yeah, you wouldn't, if somebody would ask you, do you know all there is to know about it, you would say, no, I don't. And even still, you're content. You know, there's a feeling of contentment about it because your mood is content. And then you check in with the same person about how's your inside-out understanding doing when their mood has dropped a little, where their thinking is a little more colored by insecure thought. And they'll be like, you know, I don't quite have a handle on it. I don't quite seem to grasp where I don't know. You know, and that you would pick up a little bit of uncertainty and a feeling of, you know, concern in their voice. That's what I sense in myself, right? That's what I see in myself, is that I think it's the quality of my inside-out understanding that's moving, or that is actually, you know, problematic or helpful or not. And really, it's not the understanding I have in the given emotion. It's the mood I'm in, you know. So I would suggest that that's what's happening in this context as well.
Like the truth is the same no matter what. It's kind of a matter of like how much, like you have like the same, is it like, I guess like you have the same understanding but a different mood? Or you're saying mood understanding is the same?
Your mood is really what you're under. Like if I were to talk to you or anybody who's gained and really has appreciation for learning about the Muna and this inside-out understanding, in a moment of, you know, calm and peace, and I were to say to you, so have you grasped it? Like, did you get it? Do you feel like you've got it? You'd say, like, no, I definitely don't. I don't sound like I've mastered this, but I see and appreciate what I do understand, and I trust that I'm on a learning curve, and I'm okay with the fact that I don't know all there is to know, because it's not really on me to get it at a given moment, you know, like I'm seeing things as the Almighty is showing me things, and I'm looking to be present to that. You know, you would have a certain equilibrium, even knowing that there's limits to your knowledge and understanding, right? But then I catch that same person in a slightly more insecure state, and I say, so how are you doing in the inside out understanding business? And they would start to say, well, I have some issues there because I don't get this and I don't get that, you know, and it wouldn't necessarily be that their overall grasp of the understanding has changed, it's that their mood has changed. And that's what we're doing, is all we're doing is acknowledging the truth now, and then again now, and then again now, that we're on the receiving end of a divine thought, and we have the ability to understand something about how that divine thought is showing up in this moment and how it accounts for my calm or my peace or my uncertainty. You know, it's the only source, it's the only factor, is what the gift I'm being shown in this thought. There's only one power source, and there's only one moment in which it's showing. So whatever residual feeling there is in a given moment is because of that gift of thought, and I can't, you know. So there's gratitude and there's acceptance. Gratitude and acceptance. That's what I'm seeing is the response that makes sense to your question.
When you say divine thought, I know the time's up. When you say divine thought, do you mean the mood also? Because the mood is really just the thought that...
Yeah, that's because you don't notice the divine thought. We don't often notice divine thought. We're living in it, right? There's nothing other than it. In many ways, we can only really notice the fact of divine thought by noticing our feeling state, You know, we can. That's where it's somewhat now palpable and feelable to us. That's why the you know, the Gemara says that, you know, whoever gets angry, he can know that he's, you know, worshiping an idolatrous, you know, he's standing in an idolatrous perspective. So that's what I would say about it feels to me that your question is one that's really indicative of a feeling of a question. And that question is not there's no real answer to that question. You know, it's
just depending on my mood at the moment, which
and that's the opportunity for your acceptance. Oh, here, look at that. That feeling of uncertainty. Where's that? You know, it feels like it's rooted in a concrete piece of information that I'm not quite clear about, you know. Not that there aren't things that we don't know and that there are answers to questions that are concrete, but there is a feeling. That's what I'm feeling a little bit in the question. And I would say I'm doing this all the time. All the time I'm walking around kind of just taking, you know, a subtle pulse and not noticing that I'm taking a subtle pulse. That is something that we do all the time. I don't know if that's helpful, but that's what I...
Thank you. Well, I'm in a good mood, so I'll say that. I don't understand all of it, but I hope one day it will make sense.
You know what? There's gratitude for the things that you do understand. There's always gratitude for the things that we don't understand, and that's one of our opportunities. All right, well, listen, I think we'll pause here because this is our time. And for anybody who's listening, I just want to wish everyone a chasiva v'chasima tova. And that's Hashem. We're back next Thursday again, and we'll continue our conversations about this time of how this understanding, the moon and inside-out understanding of the moon is relevant to the upcoming opportunity of the big holidays. And if, as always, I welcome your comments and questions at info@JewishCenterForWellbeing.com or at 845-393-1529. And I wish everyone a great week and a good Shabbos.